Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Maves, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Gary Borger, and he'll be answering your questions on The Perfect Cast. The show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded. We'll be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or the podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, which we appreciate if you'd share the podcast, and when you do, use hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Gary Borger about The Perfect Cast. The Colorado River at Lee's Ferry is called by some the world's largest spring creek. It's a massive, clear-running tailwater fishery that runs 15.5 miles from the base of the Glen Canyon Dam to the upper reaches of the Grand Canyon. At times, it gives the impression of being not one or two, but a series of parallel spring creek-like waterways. The fishing is great, and the scenery is gorgeous. Lee's Ferry Anglers provides professional guide service to this outstanding rainbow trout fishery, as well as food and lodging at Cliff Dwellers Restaurant and Lodge. See for yourself why Lee's Ferry is on every fly fisher's must-do list. Visit leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. Again, that's leesferryanglers.com or call them at 800-962-9755. Before we introduce Gary, I'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away in our show tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing, you can do so now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com. Look for the link under Gary's section that says register for our free drawing. Click on that link and fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Gary's latest book, The Perfect Cast 1. Here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Gary and I talk about during the show, and you must submit your answer along with your name and location using the text box on our homepage. So listen carefully, take great notes, pay attention, type fast, and maybe you'll be the lucky winner of Gary's latest book, The Perfect Cast 1. Our guest tonight is Gary Borger. Gary Borger holds a BS and an MS from Penn State University and a PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is Professor Emeritus of Biology at the University of Wisconsin campus in Wausau, where he taught for 28 years. During his teaching career, he taught botany, zoology lab, nature history, photography, writing in the sciences, ecology, taxonomy, and other topics. He was presented with Teacher of the Year Award on two different occasions. His achievements have been recognized in Who's Who, the Millennium Edition of Strathmore's, Who's Who in the West, Who's Who in Science and Engineering, Men of Achievement in the Dictionary of International Biography, Who's Who Among America's Teachers, Outstanding People of the 20th Century, and Outstanding People of the Millennium. And we didn't even talk about how great he is in fly fishing. So there we go. Gary, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Well, thank you, Roger. It's great to be with you tonight and with all your guests.
Yeah. Well, it's always fun to talk to you. And I know people have been, you know, are always looking forward to you being on my show because you always give us such great information. And so it'll be a load of fun. I'm always enjoying it. And we have had Gary on multiple times. Let me just check real quick, because we've been kind of following his book series, which we'll talk about in a minute. But 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. This is the seventh time we've had Gary on the show. So be sure when we're done to go out and search in our archive. Just search Gary Borger. You'll see all his shows, or go to his speakers page, which you can get to from the front page or the homepage of our website. And you'll see all the shows there that Gary's done with me. And that'll keep you busy for a good week for sure. So, well, Gary, let's talk about your latest book, The Perfect Cast. We're going to kind of work the show around that. You've taken an incredible challenge on with your fly fishing book series. Can you tell the folks about what you're working on?
Well, the current book I'm working on is The Perfect Cast 2, since I've already done Perfect Cast 1. And plus, I've got a number of other books lined up, some on nymph fishing, some on opportunistic fishing, that is, periods when there's no hatch going on. I've got books on terrestrials. Let's see what else. Fly designing, fly tying, quite a number of other things, in addition to the ones I've already done.
Right. This is number 6, I believe, isn't it?
This is number 6 in the series, yes.
Yeah, The Perfect Cast 1, and The Perfect Cast 2 will be 7. Yeah, I mean, that's, this is like a lifetime of information you're giving everybody in your books. So, folks, if you're not familiar with his series, well, Gary, we'll talk about that a little bit more later, and he'll tell you about his website where you can go buy the books from Gary directly. So, well, great. Well, you know, I have to ask this question because it's the name of your book. You know, what is The Perfect Cast?
Well, it's interesting when I do fly fishing shows and I always ask people, what do you think The Perfect Cast is? There's always one smart aleck or two in the group that'll yell, the one that catches a fish. And that's actually what I think the best definition for a perfect cast is. Everybody wants to think about the best loops, the longest distance, you know, the best cast against the wind and all those sorts of things. Those are just variations on techniques that allow you to get the perfect cast that's going to catch a fish. So taking it from that standpoint, then you begin the whole process of trying to describe how to actually make a cast that's going to allow you to catch fish, and that some people might even describe as the perfect cast.
Yeah, it's and sometimes you can't make a perfect cast, as I found out. It's, if you're not in the right place and the right angle and doing the right things, sometimes you can't get to the fish you'd like to get to, right?
Sometimes you can't, that's for sure.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
But casting, yeah, let me just describe a little bit about casting. Casting, as we know it today, didn't start until about 1850. And actually, fly fishing is 2,000 years old. So for 1,850 years, they couldn't cast like we cast today, because at that time they were fishing with what we call pole and string technology. That is, they went in the woods, cut down a pole, tied a string on the end, and went fishing. You know, we'd call it cane pole fishing, or maybe if you were sophisticated and wanted to call it a Japanese name, you could call it tenkara. But nonetheless, fishing the way we do it today, fly fishing the way we do it today, and casting the way we do it today, didn't begin until they developed bamboo fly rods, which didn't happen until around 1845. That's when Samuel Philippi, who was living in eastern Pennsylvania on the banks of the Delaware River, came up with the idea of gluing 6 strips of bamboo that he'd planed into equilateral triangles and gluing them together to form a 6-sided bamboo fly rod. About 5 years later, they came up with the idea of using Tonkin cane, which is a very strong fiber. And when they did that, then they got actual bamboo fly rods like you'd use today. In addition to that, they added guides on fly rods. There was no need for guides before that time because it only had a string tied on the end. In addition to that, it was the Industrial Revolution, and they were working on how to braid string. And somebody came up with the idea of braiding silk and making fly lines out of it. So they've developed a braiding machine that actually would braid double tapered fly lines. When that happened, something happened that could never occur in fly fishing before that time, and that was to actually shoot line, let extra fly line flow out through the guides. That hadn't happened until now, until 1850, because before that time it was just pole and string technology. But suddenly right. They could shoot line. So they could start with a 9-foot fly rod and cast to 50 feet without any problem. Of course, as soon as they did that, somebody went like, oh, you can cast 50 feet. Well, watch me. I can cast 55. Of course, competition immediately started. And by 1870 in England, there were casting clubs devoted to just distance casting. In those days, they were probably casting around 70 feet or so. But by 1899, they'd already figured out all the key ingredients for really casting. And by 1899, Walter Mansfield, who was then president of the Golden Gate Casting Club in San Francisco, stepped up to the line and made three casts that averaged 133 feet. And that record stood for 35 years. It's pretty amazing that somebody could actually cast a fly rod, single-handed fly rod, 133 feet. Even today, it's a long cast. So it was pretty amazing when he did that in 1899. But up until that time, people were experimenting with all kinds of things about casting, how to hold the fly rod, how to actually move your arm, what's the best way to move your arm to get to achieve the best kind of loop. And then they discovered that the best kind of loops and how to make the best kind of loops. So all that kind of stuff is involved in fly casting. And that's
yeah,
all.
That's,
go ahead.
That was a very long cast, 133
Yeah, it
feet,
was.
My gosh. Yeah. And I wonder if that was indoors or outdoors. Do you know?
Oh, that would have been outside. Yeah,
It would have
Golden
been
Gate Casting
outside.
Club.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah. So the people nowadays that do the casting tournaments indoors, they've got an advantage. Yeah,
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
if they can do
Interesting.
a cast indoors.
Yeah. Yeah, there you go. Yeah, that's quite the history. And I think, you know, from reading your book, in the early days of figuring this all out, you guys were all learning from each other at the time too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all of us learned how to fly cast and how to do it really well and the best way to move your arm and all that sort of thing. We sort of did that all on our own. In fact, the Fenwick Rod Company, which used to be the premium rod company in the world, actually started fly fishing schools in 1973. And when they did, they hired me as the Midwest director of the Fenwick schools. So I got to associate with all the people, the best people in the world in terms of casting. Plus, I knew all the other people from fly fishing, so I got to associate with quite a few people that were extremely competent in casting and describing casting. And one of the things that we did was we would meet each year, those of us who are Fenwick School instructors, would meet each year and talk about all the things that we did to help us teach students in a more controlled way so that they could really learn how to cast well. And that was a very interesting situation because I had an opportunity to talk with people that were from the West Coast, from the Rocky Mountains, from the East, and of course from the Midwest. I got to talk to all those different people and learn about different techniques, not only that, but different problems that they had to solve different ways. So it was very interesting and very sort of a very exciting time in fly fishing.
Yeah, I bet. And so much has been, and of course, you know, the equipment has advanced in incredible ways since then, especially with lines and rods. But now, you in your book, you talk about two cardinal rules of casting to be aware of when you're starting out, and if you've been casting for 40 years, right?
That's right.
What are those two cardinal rules?
Well, these cardinal rules were actually established by 1850. I mean, they'd already figured this stuff out right away. The two cardinal rules is whatever the rod tip does, not the rod, but the rod tip, whatever the rod tip does, the line has to do because the line goes out and runs out of the rod tip. So whatever you can make the rod tip do, you can make the line do. If the rod tip goes fast, the line goes fast. If the rod tip goes slow, the line goes slow. If you move the rod tip in an arc, the line goes in an arc. So there's lots of different things that you can do with the rod tip. The second rule is don't forget the first rule. Many people do forget the first rule. They forget the first rule and as a consequence aren't able to make the line do what they think it should be doing. And as a consequence, then they start doing other different kinds of things with their hand. And, of course, when they do that, the rod tip does different things. So it's very difficult to master the perfection of casting if you don't really pay attention and really practice a lot. And of course, that the best way to practice actually came about in 1975 when all of us got together in the Fenwick School to talk about casting. And Mel Krieger, who was then at that time the West Coast director of the schools, said, "I can teach anybody how to double haul in 15 minutes. Of course, none of us believed him because we've been working our whole lives to learn how to double haul and had a hard time teaching people how to double haul. Well, what he did was we said, "Mel, if you can do this, go around this Federation of Fly Fishers Conclave where we were meeting. You pick some people and take them out to the casting pond. You prove it." And he did. He actually went around there, picked out people. Some of them couldn't even fly cast. They'd never fly cast in their life. He actually taught them how to double haul. And the way he did it was without the fly rod. The problem is, as soon as you put the fly rod in somebody's hand, Their total focus is on getting as much line as they possibly can out as far as they can possibly go. And they thrash and bang around, and most people can't really learn how to cast well that way, but they can learn how to cast really well without the fly rod. So as soon as I saw him do that, I said, that's the way you teach all fly casting. So I really recommend that people practice without the fly rod, practice moving their arm correctly so that when they pick up the fly rod and do the casting, it actually will work. When Jason was 4 years old, he wanted to learn how to fly cast. He actually caught his first fish by himself when he was 2 and a half. But when he was 4, he wanted to learn how to cast with one hand and not with both. So I just had him do the pantomime. We spent the whole winter, whenever we'd be setting the table, he'd cast with one hand and carry the plate with the other hand, or carry whatever it was with the other hand, yeah. So when the spring came and I gave him a new fly rod, I made him a fly rod that was 6 foot long for a 5-weight fly line. And when I gave that, I actually turned the handle down so it would fit his small hand. When I gave that to him and he cast, the first time was perfect, because that's the only arm movement he knew once he learned that arm motion. So he's been really good since that time, obviously, and he's really very skilled at teaching other people how to do that too.
Yeah. Well, he wrote a whole book on casting too.
He's done two different books. Two different books on casting.
Yeah. Excellent books as well. I think I remember reading in your book too where you said, "Don't practice casting when you're fishing." Right?
You never practice casting when you're fishing because you're always focused on the fish.
Yeah.
You never focus
on
practicing. The best way to practice is to go. Actually, the best way to practice. And just sit in your living room and practice the casting stroke. That's probably the best thing. Because once you develop that arm motion, you get the correct arm motion, then it's going to work every time no matter what.
What do you think of those little practice rods that they have for kids and stuff?
Those are actually pretty good. Yeah, those are pretty good. Echo makes one. I mean, there's a number of them out there. Lee and Joan Wolf actually came up with the first one. They called it the Flyo. And they use a heavy yarn as the fly line. But that doesn't work nearly as well as macrame yarn. And the one that Echo puts out, they put out with macrame yarn as the line and then use that heavy yarn as a leader on the end of it. Yeah, that actually works really well. You can actually shoot line with that thing and do all the line manipulations. Yeah, it's interesting. You can actually do all the line manipulations with it too. Very interesting.
Cool. Yeah. Bob Krenn in Michigan wrote in and asked, is practicing casting on grass anything near as good as practicing on water? After all, water's surface tension helps load the rod. Where does it?
Well, actually, it's just the weight of the fly line that loads the rod. I mean, there's a tiny bit of loading, maybe with the frictional resistance of the line against the water. But really, the action of the fly rod depends upon the way in which the fly rod actually bends when you cast and pick up and cast 30 feet of fly line. Everything in fly casting is based on the way in which the rod performs with 30 feet of fly line out of the tip. That's because back in the old days, when they just started doing all this kind of stuff, they didn't have designations on fly rods like they have today. What they simply did was use silk fly lines, and the silk fly lines weighed a certain amount, so they'd simply lettered all the fly lines. So you could get a fly line that was an A, a B, a C, a D, an E, an F, a G, H, or an I. And those fly lines weighed different amounts. But when they designated the fly rods, they might say, like, takes a size D line. That meant it weighed a certain amount because it was always braided silk back in the old days. When they went to plastic-coated fly lines, they made fly lines that were floating and fly lines that were sinking. And the sinking fly lines were thinner in diameter than the ones that were floating. So if they simply designated it by a size D, it was way too heavy for a sinking line and a little bit too light for a floating line. So they've gone to numbering the fly lines now, 1 through 15. And the number designates the actual weight of the fly line. So, for example, a size 5 fly line is 140 grains. So if it's 140 grains for the first 30 feet, then it's considered to be a number 5 line. Then what rod manufacturers did was designate the rods by the line weight with that they were designed to cast. So instead of saying it cast a size D, maybe it would say it cast a size 6 fly line or a 5 fly line, depending upon the manufacturer and what they wanted to do with their fly rods. So all of that has, you know, fitted together with how you actually cast and with what happens when you do cast. So it's a very interesting intermix of the way in which the manufacturers have designated their fly rods now and what they're actually made out of and how they perform and all that sort of thing. Very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, it seems that they've all kind of come together under a common, you know, specification too. I mean, most fly lines are indicated by the weight, and most fly rods are indicated by the weight. So you can buy one person's fly rod, another person's fly line. But yet, sometimes you find that one fly line will work better if it's a little heavier on a certain rod as well, right?
Yes, and that depends upon the way in which the line is assembled and manufactured. Some companies actually overweight their lines. In other words, they say, this is a six line, it's actually a six and a half. And they do that because in graphite especially, people have gone to faster and faster rods that are stiffer and stiffer and stiffer. As a consequence, most people can't perform very well with those very stiff fly rods. So oftentimes, if a fly rod's a little bit too stiff, I'll tell people, overline the rod. In other words, if it says a 6 on it and it feels stiff to you, put a 7 on it. Then the rod actually performs a little bit better for you if you do that. And if you're fishing in areas where you're not having to cast more than 30 feet all the time, you're actually casting like 15 or 16 feet of fly line in small streams, you're better off using a heavier line on the rod because a heavier line will actually make the rod flex a little bit better.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, let's talk. Well, I need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll talk about common grips. You know, what are most common, what are better than others. So we'll come back and talk about that in just a minute. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gary Borger about the perfect cast. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Gary, I always ask my guests, you know, what's going on in your fly fishing world? You just finished that book. You told us you're working on the next, keeping yourself busy, and you just got off the show circuit too, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I've got a couple more Zoom meetings set for this spring yet too.
Okay.
Zoom
club
meetings with clubs.
Yeah. Yeah, that changed the world, right? I mean, COVID changed the world to where you can visit clubs virtually now, which is maybe makes a lot more sense. Do you enjoy doing it that way? Or do you enjoy the in-person shows better or clubs
better? I enjoy both of them, actually. They each have some advantages. For example, when I'm doing it by Zoom, all the questions wait until the end. When I'm doing it in person, sometimes I get questions actually during the talk, which is fine. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
They're both interesting and both fun, and I can use the same kind of programs for both of them. Because when you're on Zoom, you can set that so that it will show what your screen shows. So then I can bring up a program and just show the program and go through and discuss things that way.
Yeah. Give people your website too, so that they know, you know, where they can get your books and so forth.
Okay, the book is available from the Angling Bookstore, all one word, .com.
Oh, okay. You're going through Ben's store there. Okay.
That's the easiest way to do it right now.
Okay. Rather than go to your website, all right?
Yep.
But if they want to keep track of what you're up to?
Yeah, they can just go to GaryBorger.com.
Easy enough, GaryBorger.com. Great. So any traveling this summer for fishing? Or?
Oh, yeah. Since we're living in Washington State, we have to go and see some rivers that we haven't fished before. And there's a lot of fishing for steelhead and salmon in this state. There's more trout fishing in Oregon, so we've traveled down into Oregon to do some trout fishing there, and then also visit some other places here in this state, in Washington State. There's three national parks here in Washington. There's Mount Rainier, which we're going to see again this summer. There's the Olympic National Park, which is up by Seattle. And then there's the Northern Cascades Park, which is up on the Canadian border. We haven't seen any of those, so we're going to spend some time this summer running around and seeing all these places. We've been over on the coast and seen all the stuff over there and having a really good time. So we'll probably spend some time on the coast again this summer, too.
Nice, nice. Sounds exciting. Yeah. Lots of nice places to visit up there. I just got a comment here on the internet, Gary. It says, first of all, it says, I think this is starting out to be one of your best programs I've been a part of. And he says, I went to the Fenwick Fly Fishing School in West Yellowstone in 73 or 74. Tough to recall the exact date. So that's interesting. Yeah, going back
it is.
To those school days. Yeah. So somebody remembers going to one of those. Yeah. Okay, well, let's talk about the grips.
Sure.
You spent a lot of time in your book talking about the grips. Are there some that are more common than others? Are there some that work better than others? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, the most common grip among fly fishers today is what we call the thumb-on-top grip. So you put your thumb on top the rod handle, and your other fingers cup around. And typically, your thumb is opposite your index finger, so that you can squeeze the rod handle between your index finger and your thumb. But then, of course, your other three fingers are underneath. Now, that is a grip that was used when fly casting very first started back in 1850. And it was actually used for what we call the wrist cast. They would hold their upper arm against their body, hold their forearm parallel to the ground, and then just flick the rod back and forth with their wrist. And that's a really good grip for doing the wrist cast. However, the wrist cast is not a really good cast because it doesn't allow you to cast very far. It doesn't mean you shouldn't use it. I mean, I use it when I'm trying to cast close, and I maybe want to just cast a leader and a couple of feet of fly line, and then I'll just use a wrist cast. There's no sense in moving my arm very much. It's typically a cast I'll use when I'm trying to cast to a fish that's very close. I don't want the rod to move too much, because if the rod moves a lot, the fish might see it. So that's the one that most people use. And there's still a lot of casters that use wrist casting or forearm casting rather than whole arm casting. Whole arm casting is the best casting stroke. And actually the best grip for that came about in about 1870. When you look at some of the old literature, especially when you try to read literature on fly tying and things, one of the people that comes up is Frederick Halford. He's considered the father of modern dry fly fishing. Actually, he's not the father of modern dry fly fishing. George Selwyn Marriott is actually the guy that taught Halford everything. So George Selwyn Marriott was actually a really good caster. In fact, he's called the Prince of the Fly Fishers because in England, he's maybe the best fly caster that ever lived and maybe the best fisherman that ever lived. It was incredible. He could catch fish nobody else could even touch. But anyway, in his book, Frederick Halford says, my old friend George Selwyn Marriott and most other dry fly fishers of this era, in addition to putting their thumb up, also put their finger up. In other words, they had their thumb on top and then they had their finger up on the upper side of the rod too. You don't have to have your finger completely on the top, but up along the upper side. That allows you to cast much better than if you just have your thumb on top. The reason you can cast better is because you can point better with your index finger than you can with your thumb. You can also then, when you're practicing casting with the pantomime method, use your finger like it was the fly rod. Whatever your end of your finger does, the end of the fly rod would do. So it's very interesting that you can how you can practice with this. And the best grip is the one I call it the three-point grip, because you have the heel of your hand, your thumb, and your finger, index finger, up on top of the rod, and your middle finger, your ring finger, and your little finger underneath the rod. And then I also hold the rye rod back as far as I can. And I actually put the heel of my hand on the reel seat. The reason I do that is to center the weight of the reel in my hand rather than having it hanging down below the rod where it can vibrate and cause the tip to vibrate. It's a very interesting way to hold the fly rod when you put your thumb up on your, and your index finger up there. It's one of those kind of things that's that most people, when they look at that, they say, you know, well, that, you know, and then they, oh, I don't know, and then they try it, and oh my goodness! In fact, I've had people in my casting classes that were wrist casters and tell them you have to put your finger up, and then as soon as they do that, they have to do a whole arm cast because they can't bend their wrist back far enough with their finger up there to actually make a wrist cast. It's very interesting to be able to do that.
Now, and that's the, what do you call that one? The three finger?
We call this a three-point grip because there's three points on top of the handle, the heel of your hand, your thumb, and your index finger, and then 3 points underneath the handle, your middle finger, your ring finger, and your little finger. So it's 3 points above and 3 points below.
Interesting.
That's why we call I've seen it listed in several other places, but nobody's ever named it anything. So many years ago, I named it the three-point grip, and that's what we call it now.
Oh, okay, okay, yeah. Yeah, now I'm thinking that the way that most people cast with their thumb on the top is because that's where, you know, that plus your forefinger are the two strongest fingers you have, right? Is that why people default to that generally?
I think a lot of people default to it because it started out that way with wrist casting.
And
a lot of people still use their wrists. And if you're going to use your wrist in casting, your thumb on top is probably better than if you're using your whole arm in casting. When you use your whole arm in casting, you do use your wrist, but having your finger up there does not allow you to bend your wrist back very far. In fact, I'd have a really nice demonstration when I'm doing casting in but the fly fishing shows. I make a cast with my thumb on top and bend my wrist back as far as it'll go. Then my thumb is actually pointing backward, and the fly rod's actually pointing backward. And people can actually do this if you just give me a six-shooter kind of thing, you know, with your thumb and your index finger pointing forward, and then make a back cast. You can see your index finger points up and your thumb points back. So the fly rod actually stops more in an upright position than it does when you have your thumb on top. This makes it very easy to make a back cast. You simply lift your wrist and flip it back, and you get a really nice back cast that way. I was going to say, rather than if you have your thumb on top and you flip your wrist all the way back, then you don't get good back cast. You just get a great big line arc flipping back there, and that never allows you to make good forward casts.
Okay. Phil in Kentucky wrote in here on the internet. He says, I have noticed that rather than have the reel directly under the rod during a cast, some casters rotate the rod so the reel is tilted at an angle. The idea is for the line to make less contact with the rod blank, reducing friction and line slap. What do you think of using the tilted reel technique?
I don't really tilt the rod at all. I just keep the reel directly under the rod. It doesn't actually increase the amount of line slap at all.
Okay.
And I actually let the line, when I'm shooting line, I actually let the line run through my hand. I just make an O-ring with my index finger and my thumb of my left hand and let the line run through there so that it doesn't slap against the rod and so that it doesn't flip up and get around the back of the reel or around the butt of the rod or wrap around the rod butt itself. So doing that allows you to control what's happening with the line much better than just letting go of it like it was a hot potato. Mm-hmm. In addition, if you've got the line in your hand, as soon as it touches the water, you can stick it under a finger of your rod hand. Just close your line hand, put the line under finger of your rod hand, then you can retrieve from behind that finger of your rod hand. That's a much more controlled way. This actually came from nighttime fishing, because at nighttime you can't see the fly line, and if you don't have control of it all the time and you get a big fish on, you've got serious problems. So you let the line shoot through your hand, stick it under a finger of your rod hand, and then retrieve from behind that finger. That gives you much better control of the line. It makes it much easier to handle the line, much easier to do something like double haul or something.
Right. Yeah, I've sometimes seen people that are casting and they aren't controlling the line at all. They just shoot the line and let go of it. But then all kinds of things can go wrong at that point, right?
Oh, yeah, and usually does too.
Yeah. What about, you also wrote in your book about a stance. Does that make a whole lot of difference? And I'm assuming it would for whole arm casting as opposed to forearm casting, right?
It can make a difference depending upon what you're trying to do. some people like to stand just with their feet, you know, the same distance in front of them, and actually basically right underneath your shoulders. There's nothing wrong with that. It's called a neutral stance. There's nothing wrong with that stance at all for casting. Doesn't matter whether you whole arm cast, wrist cast, or whatever. But some people, if you're trying to do a cast called the Galway cast, in which you actually cast in both directions, you actually make a forward cast in both directions, then it's best to do what we call an open stance. That is, turn around so that you're actually at right angles to the direction you want the final cast to end up. Then you cast across the front of your body. This allows you to look to your, for example, look to your right side and see a hole in the weeds or hole in the branches or something. Make a cast into that, then turn your body and turn your fly rod around and cast to the left where the fish is. This cast actually originated in Ireland and on the Galway River in Ireland, and it's a very effective cast. Likewise, if you make a what we call a completely closed stance, this would be where you're facing at right angles in the other direction, so you can actually make a Galway cast in the other direction. So it's very interesting, you know, the way you stand. Some people like to do what they call an open stance, that is, put their casting arm side foot forward and put the rod arm side foot backward. This opens you up a little bit. The only problem with that is when you're casting, a lot of people will arc their rod out and arc it around behind them, rather, as they often when they do that in the backstroke. And when they do, it actually throws the fly line around to their left side behind them. So when it comes forward, it could catch you. You know, if the wind is blowing a little bit especially, the line could catch on you, or it could catch on the rod, or the fly could catch the back of your neck, or it could catch on the rod. I know guys that have broken their fly rod doing that because the fly comes forward and actually hits the fly rod. And if it's got weight on it, like a plowser minnow or something, it can actually break the fly rod.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. Good thing to know. Tell us about what ALE is.
ALE is an acronym that my son Jason came up with when he was living in Hollywood. He'd get calls from all kinds of people because he was the shadow caster in the river. A movie, A River Runs Through It, and they all knew that he was the fly caster. So he'd get calls from all kinds of people, directors, actors, you know, just people that worked on movies, and have him come and help them figure out how to cast better or tune them up a little bit. So he came up with the idea of ALE. The rod tip has to accelerate in as straight a line as possible. It then flicks out of the way to make a line loop, and then it stops or transfers the energy to allow the energy from the rod and the motion of the arm to go into the fly line and cause it to cast. So I'll just give you a definition of casting. Casting is those motions necessary to energize the line and send it to target. So whatever motion it is that you're using to send the line to target, the rod tip's got to go in a straight line, flip out of the way to make the line loop, and then stop to allow the energy from the rod and the moving arm to be transferred into the fly line and direct it to target.
Okay. So,
A stands for acceleration, L stands for loop formation, E stands for energy transfer.
And then you go back forward with the same motion. Yeah.
Yes, those three apply in both the back cast and the forward cast.
And the forward cast, yeah. Okay. So can you, now are you, I'm trying to, I kind of got the impression that a full arm cast is what you use more often, or when do you go switch from that forearm cast to the full arm cast?
Well, if I was going to use a wrist cast, it would be for things very close where the rod tip doesn't have to move very much. If I was going to use I basically never use on a forearm cast, because a forearm cast, you have to have your upper arm welded to your body, and then you just cast with your forearm and your wrist. Mm-hmm. A whole arm cast, you use your entire arm, and the point of rotation is actually your shoulder. So it's more like a karate chop kind of motion. You raise the fly rod up by as high as your face, then you drop your elbow down and make a sort of a karate chop motion. And if you just allow gravity to drop your arm down, you get the feeling of the way it should move. If you raise your arm up beside as high as your face, and then just let gravity drop your arm down, you get an idea of the way it has to move. That's
David,
probably the best way. Go ahead.
Okay. No, I didn't finish up.
I was going to say that's probably the best way to achieve casting of any distance, because it allows you to do all sorts of things besides just cast a line in a straight line. You can cast it in curves. You can do all sorts of things that way. There's lots of different ways you can move the rod when you're using your entire arm. Your entire arm casting motion gives you the greatest range of possible motions with the fly rod and with your, you know, and because of that, you can do the most number of things.
Okay. Okay. David in Colorado says, if the forward cast does the, in the forward cast, does the wrist break when you abruptly stop in the downstroke? If you don't do that, if I don't do that, I lose all the momentum in the cast and line. I heard it should not break and move the whole arm downward. What are your thoughts?
Well, the arm should move downward, but at the end of the stroke in the forward cast, the wrist has to flip forward because that's the time when you make the loop. That's the way you make the loop, is allowing your wrist to flip forward as far as it'll go. And again, if you have your finger up on the side, it basically ends up at a 45-degree angle, the rod does, which gives you a medium-sized loop, which is perfect for most fishing.
Okay, okay. So he's doing it right from the way
right.
He described it, sounds like. Yeah, yeah. So there you go, David. I'm going to skip a couple of these questions here. So controlling the loop, this is always the big thing with folks is, you know, how do you control the loop? So can you tell us how you control the loop? What do you do right? What you do wrong?
Sure. Loop control was actually established in about 1870 in England. They figured out by that time that the way they were going to get distance was to get good loops. The loop is what looks like a U lying on its side. So as the fly line flows forward, it forms this thing that looks like a U lying on its side. I want to give you a couple of names. The distance from what we call the nose of the loop, that's the rounded portion out in front. The distance from that nose back to where the fly is called the fly leg. The distance from the rounded end or the nose on the end of the loop back to the rod is called the rod leg. So when you're making good casts, the rod leg and the fly leg should be parallel to one another. If you're making bad casts, they can be all over the place. If they're parallel to one another, especially if the fly leg, which is the distance from the nose back to the fly, is flat, the loops go the furthest. It doesn't matter if they're big loops, if they're small loops, or if they're medium loops. If the fly leg is flat, the loop will go the furthest. So it doesn't matter how you make them and what size they are. But in order to achieve that, you've got to have a really good casting stroke. You've got to practice a bunch so that it happens. When it does happen and you get those kind of loops, you can cast 70 feet with just the weight, with just gravity dropping your arm down. It's pretty easy to cast that kind of distance. When you're trying to cast distances like 80 or 90 feet, it gets a little more difficult simply because as the line speed increases, the air resistance, instead of just increasing the same amount, the actually increases by a fourth, maybe four times. So if, say, the line's going 100 miles an hour, then the wind resistance would be just four times that, what it would if you increase the line speed by half to 150, then the air resistance would actually be four times what it was at 100. So most people don't understand that. They think that if they can get the line to go faster, it'll obviously go much further. Well, maybe if you're on the moon where there's no air, that would happen, but not in this world.
So how do you practice controlling your loop when you're by yourself?
The best way to practice is to practice without the fly rod. Everybody thinks that they got to get the fly rod, and as a consequence, when they put the fly rod in their hand, they just cast the same old way they always did. If they practice without the fly rod, pantomime method, until they get that motion down, get it locked down really well, then when they go to make line loops, those things will automatically be generated. When you start with the fly rod, you've made a back cast, a good back cast, and you start with the fly rod up as high as your face and simply let your elbow drop down and swing forward, and then stop and flip your wrist over. You'll always make good loops doing that. And if you do it, no matter how badly you think you cast, you'll be casting and making good loops every single time if you do it that way, that karate chop method. You'll make good casts every single time.
Let me take a secret. Oh, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you take long pauses, and then I step on you. Finish up, because I'm going
to right.
Finish.
Finish your up. If you got to take a break, we'll take a break, and I'll finish when I get back.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves with creating a unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you, or you would like to tie your own, be sure to visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Gary Borger about the Perfect Cast. If you'd like to ask Gary a question, go to our homepage, fill out that form, send it in, and we'll see if we can't get Gary to ask it, to answer it. So, Gary, back to it. You were going to finish talking about?
About the backcast. Mm-hmm. The way to make a really good backcast. Most people, when they make a backcast, lift their arm, if they're doing a whole arm cast, they lift their arm, then they flip their wrist. The only problem with that is it doesn't make a really good backcast. The backcast will always extend and drop as it, I mean, it drops because gravity is pulling it down. So as it extends backward, it'll drop and it'll be below the horizontal of the, when it finally straightens out, which means that when you make the forward stroke, you have to cast up over top the fly rod, pull the line down, and cast downward in the front. So what you do is, as you're making the backstroke, instead of just lifting your arm and then flipping the wrist back, as you lift and flip together, so that you're actually lifting, and as you're flipping, you're also continuing to lift. This pushes the fly rod up, and if you do it with your, you know, with just your hand, you can see when you do that, that you're pushing the fly rod upward. And as you do that, the line flows up and back, and it's very, very fast, and you get good tight loops. That way, by the time it gets back there, it hasn't even fallen down to the horizontal. So when you make the forward cast, it always works out really well.
When you're doing a back cast, is there, and I know you're going to probably refer back to that Galloway cast, but is there a limit as to how much line you want to have out on your back cast? In other
well,
words...
Again, that, yeah, that depends yeah. on line design. For example, if you have typically have a line that's a weight forward line with only a 30-foot head on it, then I wouldn't have more than 35 feet of line out when making the back cast, for the simple reason that when you get beyond the head, you're trying to cast a heavy head with a thin running line, and you can't transfer enough energy into the head to keep it up well. So if you're using a double tapered fly line, on the other hand, you can put the whole thing out there and behind you if you want to. But most people don't. Most people don't know how to shoot line on the backstroke, and as a consequence, sometimes they'll try to pick up like 50 feet of fly line, and it's a weight forward line. You can't pick it up unless you really know how to really, really haul well. Then you can pick it up. But most people don't do that. As a consequence, you can get really bad back loops because of having the running line, which is real thin in diameter, trying to cast that big, heavy weight head. And so it won't cast well.
Yeah, it seems like at a, and that's trying to keep a large amount of line in the air at speed can be difficult, at least from my experience. And it sounds like that's maybe what the problem is getting past that, getting into the running line where you're losing control kind of the momentum.
Yeah, that's often the case, yep.
Okay.
Now, tournament casters use much longer heads than fly fishermen do. For example, the guys in tournament casting for distance might use a head that's like 70 to 80 feet long, whereas a fly fisherman probably wouldn't use a head much over about 45 feet, simply because when you're fly fishing, you're not casting that far. But when you're tournament casting, you're trying to cast great distances, as much distance as you can probably achieve. And so they try to hold a big head because when they do that, there's got more mass. And the distance you can cast is actually dependent upon the amount of momentum that you can generate in your fly line. And momentum is equal to mass times velocity. So if you can make the line go fast and you have a heavy line, it'll go further than a lighter line.
Do they have specific lines made for distance casting?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, okay. So always talk about a tailing loop.
Okay.
How do we get, how does that happen, and how do you not get it to happen?
Yeah, Well, I'll tell you what tailing loops are. A tailing loop is when the fly leg, that's the distance from the nose of the loop back to the fly, actually dips down below the rod leg, which is the distance from the nose back to the fly line, back to the fly rod tip. So if the fly leg dips below the rod leg, then what can happen is you get a loop in the line, and the fly can actually go through that loop and tie knots in the leader, or it can tie knots in the fly line, depending upon how you generate it. The reason that tailing loops are generated is because the rod tip does not go in a straight line. It goes in a concave pathway. That is, it starts out high, goes down low, and goes back up high again. That happens when people push the fly rod straight forward. Because the fly rod is not a stiff object, it's actually a flexible stick, and because it's flexible, it bends. So if you push it forward, it bends down, and then as you show it forward, it eventually goes back up again because the rod extends when it's stopped. It unflexes. And so when it unflexes, it actually aims the line up. So first it aims the line down, and then it aims the line up. And in that process, somewhere in the middle, it's got to cross. Physics won't allow it to do other than that. Now that's generated. Tailing loops are typically generated by people either jerking the fly rod or pushing the fly rod straight ahead. So when you jerk it as you start, the fly rod tip dips down, then it flexes back up again. And if you push it straight ahead, it dips down and flexes back up again. So you always end up with tailing loops when you do it that way.
Okay, okay. Common problem out there, right?
It is.
What other common mistakes do you see people make?
A very common mistake is trying to cast heavily weighted flies or split shot with a normal dry fly cast. Actually, the best way to cast is with what we call an elliptical stroke. You make the back cast more sidearm and the forward cast more with the rod straight up. This technique was actually developed in the 1930s by a guy by the name of Hans Gebetsreuther on the Tron River in Austria. And he taught it to a tournament caster named Albert Goddard, who then brought it to the United States and told everybody in the United States it was called the Belgian wind cast. So if you hear of the Belgian cast or the Belgian wind cast, it was actually brought into this country by Albert Goddard, who was a Belgian. He was a tournament caster. But it was actually developed in Austria in the 1930s by Hans Gebetsreuther, who was a guide on the River Tron.
And so that's why we see more tangles and so forth in the leader with double nymph rigs with weights and everything going on, because
they're
trying to cast.
That's a good way. If you try to dry fly cast those, you'll get so many knots and other things. Oh my gosh, you'll spend all day untangling the thing.
Yeah.
You should make a back cast with your arm more sidearm, and then the forward cast of the rod more straight up. So the back cast, and then you just come right around and make the forward cast. You don't need really wait very long.
Yeah. You just kind of swing it out there.
Right.
David Schlom in California wrote, and he says, I've seen and heard the exercise of using a paintbrush loaded with water and practicing flicking it so that it sprays out at eye level onto a wall or fence or whatever as a way to get a good stop on the forward cast. Is that a good way to go? What position, clock, etc. should I be stopping at, and what are some tips to do this? I have a tendency to shoot my line out with the rod too parallel to the water, I think. Is it analogous to the stop on the back cast?
Well, actually, if you want to use a paintbrush, that's a good way to do it. But the thing is, you can't have the water spraying on a big spray from the top to the bottom. It can't be like a 6-foot arc that the water's flying into. You should have it basically hitting a spot out in front of you. So if it hits the wall, that's fine. But it should be hitting a spot and not spraying up and down the wall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of practice is good. Now, where you stop the fly rod on the forward stroke is so that the fly rod is actually pointing about 45 degrees above the horizontal. But then if you want to really shoot a lot of fly line, what you actually do is you lift the butt of the fly rod up so it is more parallel to the water. Because it's more parallel to the water, the line doesn't have as much friction as it runs through the guides. It doesn't have to bend as it goes over the tip, goes through and over the tip-top guide. So because it's flatter and because it's running more evenly through the guides, there's less friction, and so it'll go further that way. It's a very common thing that people do when they're shooting line, is lift the butt of the fly rod.
Yeah, I noticed that, especially, in the salt, when guys are double hauling, and they do that when they finally release, they've got their arm, the rod, everything almost straight out. Yeah. And that's just what you've just described, I think.
There's a lot of people that do that, especially if they're trying to shoot for distance.
Right. Oh, okay. This is a different one. Ed in Wisconsin, he says, I'm a right-handed caster. Can you speak about how the positioning of the hands affect the cast, mainly the left hand? Should it be more in front of your chest or near the hip, near or further from the right hand?
That's a very interesting one, because Charles Ritz in his book, A Fly Fisher's Life, recommended that everybody hold their line hand down by their hip. Only problem is, if you're standing in water, that's a very difficult place to hold your fly line. Actually, what you should do, if you think about it for a minute, when you make a back cast, the distance between your line hand, no matter where it is, and the first guide on the rod increases because the fly rod's going back and up. On the forward stroke, if you make a forward stroke and keep your hand, your line hand in the same place, the distance between your line hand and the first guide on the fly rod decreases, because now the fly rod's coming down and forward. And because it's going down and forward and line's going up through the guides, you cannot generate as good a cast as if you kept both hands moving at the same pace. So hauling allows you to control the tension of the line in the fly, the tension of the fly line in the guides. And because you have greater tension on the fly line in the guides at all times, you get a better transfer of energy from the fly rod to the line, and also you get a better transfer of energy because you're pulling on the line. So as a consequence, a lot of people, once they learn to double haul, will double haul all the time when they're fly casting. Doesn't matter for short hauls, or for short distance or long distance. I basically haul on almost every cast, simply because I can keep more tension on the fly line and better get a better transfer of energy from the fly rod to the fly line.
Yeah, I noticed that after I learned how to haul, that I was just kind of doing it naturally. I wasn't even thinking about it, kind of like what you're saying.
That's true. That's very true. Most people do that.
Yeah, yeah. Mark in Pennsylvania, he says, I'm in the process of trying to move from an intermediate caster since the mid-80s to advanced, and I feel like I have more questions now than ever. The thing I struggle with, besides making a better back cast, is how much line should I be able to carry as opposed to shooting. I grew up with double taper lines, and you could hold a ton of line. With my various lines today, I have 30 to 45 foot heads, and I struggle to carry 15 feet more line and able to shoot more than just head out of rod tips and shooting. I'm asking for my purpose of casting for smallmouths on the Susquehanna River or dry fly fishing in the upper Delaware, where I need to make a 70-foot cast. It sounds like just what you just talked about the heads and so forth, right?
Yeah, if you use like a 45-foot head, you should be able to cast to 70 feet without any problem, just making a regular cast without even hauling. But a lot of people, you can actually learn to cast by hauling, and then as a consequence, you can hold at least another 15 feet beyond the head. So if you had a 45-foot head, you could hold 60 feet of line in the air without any trouble at all.
Okay.
But most
okay.
people don't understand that and can't haul well. And as a consequence, because they can't haul well or can't haul at all, they shouldn't hold more line in the air than about, if you have a 45-foot head, not more than about 50 feet, which would allow you to cast to 70 without any problem.
Okay. Okay. Ed in Denver says, if most fish are caught by most Colorado fly fishers within 40 feet or less, why should they learn to do a perfect cast to cast 20 feet plus further? And he says, asking for a friend, right? You know, when they say they're asking for a friend.
Right. Well, I'll tell you what, there's a lot of lakes in Colorado that have really good damselfly hatches, and there's tons and tons of trout in those lakes. And if you're going to lake fish, you better be able to cast more than 45 feet. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah.
I used to teach fly fishing schools on a ranch down in New Mexico called Vermejo Park. And Vermejo Park Ranch had 27 lakes on it. So we would take all of our students to fish on those lakes. And then during the time we had off in the week, we'd go fishing on the lakes. So a friend of mine came up from Albuquerque to teach with me in those schools. At the end of the time, he was a mathematician. At the end of the time, he said, you caught 30% more fish than I did. And I said, what do you mean? He said, why do you think you caught more than fish than I did? And I said, because I'm a better fisherman, obviously. And he said, no, because you can cast 30% further than I can. So when you're fishing lakes, the further you can cast, the better, because you can reach fish that the other people can't reach. Of course, the next year he owned his casting all the time. Then the next year, when he came to fish, well, he cast the same distance I could cast, so we both caught the same number. But it's very interesting that it's very interesting, especially in lakes. And there's lots of places I fish that I have to cast more than 40 feet on a stream, especially in bigger streams. If you ever get up to fish the rivers like the Madison and so on, you're basically there and over on Henry's Fork, you're casting all the time, at least 45 to 50 feet, almost every cast.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and then in the salt, too, that can make a world of difference.
Oh, yeah, in the salt, it can make a huge difference.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. You know, when you're fishing smaller streams in Colorado, then you really don't have to cast that far. He's correct.
No, you don't.
Yeah, yeah. Chuck in Placerville, California says, I often fish small streams that have a lot of bank vegetation and trees, thus not allowing a bat cast or much false casting. What are your casting suggestions for small streams?
Well, my casting suggestion for small streams is learn how to spay cast with a single-handed rod. Because if you can spay cast, you don't need very much back cast room, a little bit more than you do with a standard roll cast. But you don't need too much room behind you, and you can actually cast much further. Also, when you're making a regular roll cast, if you lift your arm as high as you can lift it, then pull it straight down before you actually finish the cast, so you can actually make bigger D-loops in your roll cast, and you can cast further that way. A lot of people just think with the roll cast, you simply let the line slide back to you. I actually pull it back so that I can keep the rod moving, and then when I make the forward stroke, I've got the momentum of the backward momentum of the fly line to cast against, and that actually increases the distance you can cast too. You can also learn how to roll cast and spay cast sidearm. So when you're casting where there's vegetation and stuff, you can actually learn how to throw underneath the overhanging branches and so on. And that's always very, very useful.
Yeah, I went and fished with Enrico Puglisi down there in Campeche, and we were fishing in those mangrove tunnels, as I call them. And yeah, you didn't have much room in there at all, above or on the sides or behind you to cast.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very, like I said, mangrove tunnels, just mangroves all around. So yeah, it caused a lot of problems. He mentioned false casting, and I wanted to bring that up because you did mention that in your book as well about false casting. Can you talk to that for a second?
Yeah, false casting is basically false fishing. So absolutely minimize the amount of false cast you have to make. One way you can do that is by the way in which you actually pick up the fly line from the surface of the water. Because if you can learn how to use the C pickup, you just make the rod tip go in a C and then immediately pick up the line. If you do that, the fly line actually jumps up off the surface. And as the fly comes around, it pops all the water out of it and actually dries it. So it's a really good way to dry a dry fly. Just make a C pickup and it's dry. You never have to false cast at all. The other thing a C pickup will do is allow you to pick up great swaths of slack line on the surface. So you can have a big pile of slack line. Just make a C with the rod tip and immediately go into the back cast. You can actually pick all that line up right off the surface. It's also a good way to set the hook. If you've got a lot of slack on the surface and the fish takes a fly, most people react by violently jerking the fly rod back and up and breaking the fish off. Just make a C pickup, and it sets the hook automatically. It's very interesting. It's a very, very effective technique for picking up the fly line. In fact, I use it almost every cast I make, simply because it's so effective at tensioning the fly line. It actually gives it more tension than just picking it straight up off the surface. So you actually get better back casts when you use the C pickup.
Now, can you describe that a little bit more when you say C pickup? Since
yes,
we can't see you or see a diagram.
Yeah, if you think of the fly rod tip making a C, starting at the top of the C and ending at the bottom of the C, that's half a circle, right? Half an O. So make a C. When you get to the bottom, you immediately make the back cast. The circle that you generate when you do that will flow down the fly line, pop the fly right off the water. And as it pops off the water, it'll also flip all the water out of the fly. So you just make a C pickup and it's dry and you make the next cast. You don't have to false cast at all.
Yeah, rather than coming straight out back out of the water, which you're dragging it through the water, you're lifting it up out of the water first. Yeah, I get you. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, good. Let's see what else we've got here from our folks. Gary, yeah, he's fishing small streams too. I fish a small river stream with a lot of overhanging trees from the bank. I have a 9 foot five weight and a double taper line. When fishing a dry fly with nymph dropper, what's the best casting technique?
Yeah, again, if you're fishing small streams, you got a lot of overhanging brush, then the best casting technique probably would be either a roll cast or a forward spay, the switch cast they sometimes call it. The forward spay or single hand spay or switch or whatever you want to call it is like a roll cast. It just puts more line behind you. And because there's more line behind you, you're actually moving more line with the fly rod tip than you are moving it when you just have a standard roll cast. Because you have more fly line that you're moving, you can energize more fly line, therefore make a much more easily made cast that way.
Jim in Ohio, he says, with all the Euro nymph mania taking center stage like a horde of rogue kayakers through my favorite fishing hole, is there still a place for a 9 foot five weight?
Yeah, that's what I use is a 9 foot five weight. So it doesn't matter whether I'm nymphing or whether I'm dry fly fishing or whether I'm streamer fishing. 9 foot five weight or 9 foot six weights, probably the ideal fly rod in graphite anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's lots of places. There's lots of room for a 9 foot five weight. Plus, if there's that many people going up and down the river Euro nymphing, they probably aren't, number one, all the fish have been hooked. Number two, if there's that many people going up and down the river, you're in a too busy a place. Find another spot to fish.
Yeah, find another spot.
You know?
Yeah. Dan Lieberger in Illinois says, what is a good weight length rod to teach my grandson how to fly, to cast a fly line and the basics of fly fishing?
It depends on how old the grandson is. If he's like 10 or 12 years old, then he can just handle a 5 weight easily, a 9 foot 5 weight easily. But if he's just a small child, like Jason started when he was 4, so I had him use a 6 foot 5 weight. That worked out well when he was just that small. Depends on how old he is and how strong he is. Some kids have strong hands, some people don't. It just depends again. I mean, I've had kids as young as 10 years old in my fly fishing classes, and they were able to do it because they were able to pay attention. If kids aren't able to pay attention, if they, you know, they want to be doing something else like throwing rocks, probably better to let them throw rocks. When Jason was little, he liked to throw a lot of rocks too, so I'd let him throw rocks. And if he wanted to fish, let him fish.
Yeah. Don't push him too hard, right?
That's right.
Yeah. James in Idaho says, Gary, do you still promote being able to execute aerial mends around the clock? Also, is the Bow River and the Bighorn still as good as demonstrated by you in the groundbreaking, in your groundbreaking fly fishing videos?
Yeah, I still promote aerial mends. In fact, I tell everybody, learn how to do aerial mending because that should be your primary form of mending, and you should do on-the-water mending as your secondary form, only if absolutely necessary, or to follow up on the aerial mends that you've made. And yes, the Bighorn and the Bow River are both still very good at times. Just depends. And those years when we made those DVDs, or the videos, I guess we made, not DVDs, when we made those videos, the fishing happened to be particularly good that year. That was 1986. And we caught a lot of fish in those videos. But yeah, they're still good. The Bighorn especially is really good. And I've heard, I don't fish the Bow very much anymore because it's hard to get up there, but the guys that I know that live up there still fish it and still say, yeah, it can be very good in certain years.
Okay. Roy Fukushima in California says, can you talk about forward cast regarding softer landings in general, but especially for both dry flies for trout and lightweight shrimp flies for bonefish?
Yeah, the idea in fly casting is never to cast onto the water, but to cast always to cast above the surface. Some people like to say they like to have the fly land first. That's very difficult to do, and if you're going to do that, you have to give the fly enough energy to actually land first. But for a dry fly, it won't land first unless you overpower it. Basically, you're doing a tuck cast with it. So I don't tell people to over, you know, have the fly should land first. I say just extend the line out over the surface, aim about 3 feet above the surface, so that the fly, no matter whether it's a dry fly or whether it's a shrimp fly or whether it's a nymph, so that the whole thing gets a chance to extend and then just drop to the surface with the line and fly dropping at the same speed.
Hey, we just got a couple of questions in here on the internet. Mike in Chattanooga says, is the 10 and 2 rule really a rule, or is it more of a lore that has been passed down for many years?
Well, it depends on what you're talking about in terms of 10 and 2. If you're talking about where the rod should be stopping in terms of a clock. Yeah, it should stop probably only 30 degrees behind the vertical and should stop in the front maybe 45 degrees ahead of the vertical. If you can get it, keep it in that range, you can get really good casts every single time.
So it's not that it has to be specifically 10 and 2. It's in those ranges, right?
Yeah, it's in that range.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't go back as far as 2 if I can help it. But it just depends on what you're trying to do with the fly rod. I mean, there are times when I extend the fly rod straight out behind me when I'm trying to shoot line back there. So it just depends on what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
But for dry fly fishing, most people subscribe to the 10 to 2 for dry flies.
Yeah, yeah. We had another Phil in Kentucky says, years ago I was at a workshop in LaGrange, Kentucky. I saw Gary cast several rods at once and not getting the lines tangled. I still do not know how he did that. Perhaps he can explain.
That's when I used to wear my gold lame suit, see?
You're not going to talk about that, are you?
Well, you can cast with two rods really easily, and I think in those days, in fact, I can still do it. I can cast with four fly rods, two in each hand. It's actually not that difficult.
Tangled.
And not just tangled, yeah. If you know how to fly cast well. If you can cast well, you can do that, yeah.
Yeah,
then that
you
way
go.
You can fish with three other people and hand each one of them a rod, too, after you make the cast.
See what they do. Good way to make some bets, right, once you get that down.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think we already talked about that. Just looking at these questions coming in. Okay, we're getting near the end of the show here. Let's see what we got left. Matt in Albuquerque. I spent some time in the mid-90s when I was a teenager learning to tie flies with Bob Pelz. Talked
Bob
about
Pelz,
you often.
Yeah,
and we often tied some of your fly patterns, including one called the Devil Bug that I still remember vividly. I'm a big fan of yours and have several of your fly tying and casting books. I was just wondering if you have any stories you could share about Bob.
Well, Bob and I taught the Fenwick Fly Fishing Schools at Vermejo Ranch for many years. And so I've got lots of stories about Bob and fishing and so on and so on. But I think the idea that he was a mathematician and kept track of everything that he caught and everything that I caught and said that, you know, I could cast 30% further than he could, so I caught 30% more fish.
Oh, that was the same guy. Okay.
That was the same guy, yeah.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
In addition to that, we figured out some techniques that were very unique and some flies that were very unique for fishing those lakes down there. In Colorado, as well as down in New Mexico, there's lots and lots of blue damselflies in the lakes.
Oh, yeah.
The blue damselfly is probably the biggest hatch there is in any of the lakes in Colorado and New Mexico. And once that hatch starts, which is usually around anywhere from the middle of June to the end of June, once that hatch starts, boy, the fishing can be outstanding in lakes, just absolutely outstanding. Fishing nymphs in the morning and then the adults in the afternoon.
Right, right. Yeah, it's I've got that in a little lake that's just down the hill from me here, and the blue damsels always come out every year. And it's fun to fish the adults, too. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they get real excited about those. Okay, I think we have just one more left here. We'll finish up with that. Vernon in New York. He says, Tenkara Kuru rods and similar type fly rods require hands-on retrieval of catch. The ability to reach out farther with my bait varies with my rod length, say a 30-foot rod and leader and tippet length in a 160-degree arc from the shoreline. No reel to backlash, etc. It's a big plus. My primary fish of choice is walleye. I'm getting ready to purchase a Tenkara or Kuru rod along with accessories. At 81, am I wasting my time? Expensive, even without the added expense of a reel. Oneida Lake and Lake Erie and Secunda Daga Reservoir are the areas that I hope to be casting and pan frying in. Need your input on my senior moment.
I wouldn't use a 10-car rod for fishing for walleyes because you've got to get the fly fairly deep. Unless he's got a 60-foot fly rod, but I don't think that's the case. 10-car rods are usually between 10 and 15 feet. If that's the case, then the furthest you can cast is about maybe 35 feet, because you can have a line that's maybe 5 feet longer than your fly rod when you're casting with Tenkara. Because you can't cast very far, the fly can't get very far out and can't get very deep. And if you're trying to cast bait with it, then you've got really serious problems, because typically when people cast bait, the bait flies off, because when you make the forward stroke, the bait is going back and you go forward and it just rips it right off the hook. So most people that use Tenkara don't use bait. They use flies. In fact, Tenkara was originally designed for fishing very tiny flies in small mountain streams in Japan. That's where it came from. And that it actually developed in about 1650 in Japan. And so I wouldn't use it for walleyes. You get a good-sized walleye on, you need to let the thing run a little bit and play it. And it's very hard to do that with a Tenkara rod. You can catch bigger fish on Tenkara rods if you know how to handle a fly rod and know how to fight fish. But if you get a good-sized fish in there, I mean, like, imagine trying to catch a tarpon on a Tenkara rod. You just absolutely couldn't do it. So
yeah,
catching bigger fish on it, catching bigger fish that tend to run a lot, and especially in a lake where they could sound and go very deep, it can be very difficult. So I just use a regular fly rod, I think. I wouldn't invest in a Tenkara.
Yeah, you have a little bit more control and more line to deal with, and it's easier to retrieve the fish, especially a larger fish, being that you have to kind of grab your line to bring them in. Well, there you go, Vernon, for your senior moment. I hope Gary helped you out there. Well, we got to wind things up here, Gary. But when we return, we're going to give away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited and a copy of your latest book, The Perfect Cast. And I forgot the question I was going to ask you. Phil in Kentucky asked online here, what is the focus of your next book, Perfect Cast 2, after writing Perfect Cast 1? What is left to say?
Well, there's actually the Perfect Cast 1, the Perfect Cast 2, and the Perfect Cast 3. And and 2 and 3 are not, I mean, 3 isn't complete. It's been written, but it's not completed. But number 2 is completed. And number 2 focuses on other things of casting other than the whole arm cast and simply, you know, trying to get good loops and so on. Number 2 actually focuses on things like the thrust cast, casting for great distances, way to pick up a long fly line, and various other techniques that are used in casting. It also includes things like, not to try to think about, but an introduction to a curve casting and mending line. It includes a whole chapter on aerial mends. Let's see what else.
How much to learn, Gary?
There's a lot of things in there. There's a lot of things in there in casting. Anyway, book number 3 focuses on curve casting. When things like the tuck cast and curving to the right and curving to the left and all the different techniques that are available to do that. There's probably 50 or more different kinds of casts you can make curving the line.
Fantastic. There's your preview, Phil, so get ready. You got a lot to learn, or maybe you don't. Maybe you know all that stuff already. Not for me to judge. Okay, well, hang tight here, Gary, because we're going to give away your book in just a few minutes, and I'll be back in just 30 seconds or so.
Okay.
Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of the beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a quick reminder to everyone, before you leave the website tonight, please take a minute and give us your feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show that said, what do you think of the show? Just click on that link and leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. Now it's time to give away our prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show, so you don't miss out on some of the great prizes we have to give away. If you are one of the lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and collect the information from you so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first up is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org. flyfishersinternational.org, a great organization to support. So even if you don't win tonight, go join. And our winner for that is, let's see, Dale Ray in Michigan. Dale Ray in Michigan. So congratulations, Dale, on winning that membership to Fly Fishers International. And now we'll give away a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited, another great organization to be part of. TU.org is where you find out more information, TU.org. So check them out. And our winner for that is Bernie Robidart. Bernie Robidart in Alabama. So Bernie, congratulations on winning that membership to Trout Unlimited. Okay, so now, what is the cast that we talked about, forearm cast, modified forearm cast, full arm cast, and which cast does Gary use most regularly? Is that a reasonable question, Gary?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Okay, Phil says he thinks you had five rods casting in that one time, but you're too modest to say it was only four. Eyewitness accounts, he says, by eyewitness accounts are not reliable. okay, you just gave me all three of them. That was a grip, Chris. Not looking for a grip. What type of cast? Everybody's giving me grip. The perfect cast for when that catches fish. no, not sea casting. There we go. I think we got it here. I got full arm. That's what I was looking for. Sound good to you, Gary?
Yep.
Okay.
Full arm.
Yeah, yeah. So that's David Rona in Grand Rapids. So, David, congratulations. And I'm sure you're going to enjoy Gary's book. So, David, I need you to send me, I've got your name, I've got your email address, I need you to send me your shipping address so that Gary can ship that out to you, and I think he'll probably be nice and autograph it for you, which will be a treasure for you, and so congratulations on paying attention. Boy, we had a lot of wrong answers there. I'm surprised. I thought it was kind of an easy one, but oh, well, there we go. Hey, Gary, thank you so much for being on the show tonight and taking your time out and being with me once again. And I'm sure and I hope that you'll be willing to do it again and again and again as each one of your books comes out, because there's plenty to talk about. So thanks so much for being with me tonight.
You're very welcome, Roger. Thank you for everybody that's listening, too.
Yeah, I thank them. Yeah, they're my favorite people, the audience out there, and they make it fun and interesting. Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah. Hopefully you've all found the podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just look for the link on the top line of our menu, and in the archive you'll find all of our past shows, over 390-some shows now, which you can search by keyword phrase like trout, tarpon, Madison River, casting, whatever. Go ahead and explore. I think you'll be pleasantly surprised at what you discover out there and all the things that there are to learn about fly fishing. Our next broadcast will be on April 3rd, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'm going to interview Jim Stenson, and our topic for the show will be A Tale of Three Fish. Jim has traveled the world to fish for many species. The Holy Trinity, as some of them call them, some people call them, are still the three toughest fish to catch. Permit, steelhead, and Atlantic salmon can frustrate even the best fly fishers. Join us to hear Jim talk about some of his exciting and difficult adventures in search of these elusive fish. Be sure to add this upcoming show to your calendar. Just click the Add to Calendar buttons below Jim's photo on our homepage, and it'll add it to your favorite calendar, and you'll be all set. We'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Lee's Ferry Anglers, Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Rico Puglisi Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you're signed up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.